It's Wednesday, March 31st, 2010, and you're listening to episode 187 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 1 minute. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
My name is Pat.
And this is Chris.
This is the first show we've actually recorded after Fear the Con.
Yes.
And I'm pleased to say that per our predictions, 5 people did show up. They were just kind enough to bring 145 friends with them.
Indeed.
So we want to thank you 5 guys for your extremely hard work. All right. Reyna's Wings, the March of Dimes charity that we have been working with one of our forum users, has taken on a slightly different life.
They've started robbing banks, haven't they?
For charity. So it's cool.
Oh, so it's cool. Yeah.
It's crime for charity.
Crime for charity.
No.
I love it.
All right. So, but it was always a worthy charity. But now, in addition to being a worthy charity, it is actually now a contest. There's a mailing list I'm on for some people within the RPG industry. I have no idea what I'm doing on it, but I am. And so I decided to post on there what was going on and to see if anyone in the RPG industry wanted to get involved. And we already have 3 companies that have offered to join this effort. And what these companies are doing is they are going to put up prize support. And what we're going to do is we're offering 2 kinds of prizes. Prize number 1 is whoever donates the highest amount will be given a prize. Now, having said that, I recognize not everyone can afford to drop a lot of money on charity. And on top of that, a lot of charities say where they get most of their good money is not from the big donors. It's from large numbers of nickel and dime sort of donations. So if all
that's the whole point of the March of Dimes.
Yeah. So if all you can afford to donate is a couple bucks, I don't want to discourage you from doing that. So the remainder of the prizes, all the prizes minus 1, what we're going to do is everybody that donates is going to get their name put in a hat. We are going to draw out the names and hand out the prizes. Still don't have all the details just yet. This literally just started coming together over the past couple days. So hopefully by the next episode or at least the episode thereafter, I should have some more information. But Drive-Thru is going to get involved. Art Dream, which is the company that makes games like Monsters and Other Childish Things, and Polymancer have also, they want to get involved. And so what you need to do is after you make a donation to Reyna's Wings, you need to do 1 of 2 things, and I will include links for both of these in the show notes. You either need to send a private message on the forums to Necronomatron, who's the guy that's heading it up, and tell him, this is the name I made the donation under, otherwise he won't know who you are. Mm-hmm. Or secondly, he said that after you make a donation, you can leave a comment. You need to leave a comment stating that you are a Fear the Booter, so he knows to include your name in the raffle. Now, if you have already donated, you're still eligible. Just be sure to contact Necro and let him know who you are, and we will still include you in the drawing. Mm-hmm. To put a deadline on this, the actual walk is going to occur in about 2 or 3 weeks after this episode drops. However, they allow them to keep collecting donations for the walk after it's occurred. So the cutoff is going to be the end of May, last day of May. We will do the drawings on June 1st or thereabouts. So if you want to make a donation or have already made a donation, you need to get out there and get your business taken care of by May 31st. Item number 2, before we dig into a funny story followed by our topics for this show, is several people on our forums have been talking for a while about starting up some Blood Bowl leagues, and we've decided to go ahead and formalize this. I'm going to post some rules for the Blood Bowl leagues on our forums. If you're interested in joining, what you need to do is get on our forums and post a sign up according to the rules provided.
Now, you're talking about the Blood Bowl video game.
Yes, I'm talking about the Blood Bowl video game.
And not the Board Game Geek Play Online one.
Correct. I am talking about the video game, which right now looks like most of our guys are playing it through Steam, followed by the 360.
Do you know there's a DS version, too?
No, I didn't.
Yes.
I would doubt there's online play for it.
There might be. You can do online
play. DS does have online
play. It does have Wi-Fi.
Okay. I don't know about this game.
All right, well, but if you want to join, you need to get onto our forums and post the requisite sign-up information by noon Central Time on April 22nd. The first week of season play will begin on April 25th. So, with all that taken care of, let's get down to the meat of this episode.
Actually, I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second. I just want to point out, just to those of you who are suffering with cold weather or whatnot, I've opened up the window in my podcasting booth for the first time. So yeah, you may or may not hear birds. There's some Canadian geese hanging about, but the window's open.
Birds, crickets, and drive-bys.
Whether we hear birds, we will hear wind.
Yes.
So, funny Fear the Con story that didn't come out until after the convention was over, because it didn't occur until after the convention was over, was on Saturday night, we left the con, and a bunch of us went for a post-con meetup over at Denny's, which we do every year, to basically talk about what
went right. There were two Denny's groups?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, there are two Denny's. There's one by the hotel and one by the con center. Mm-hmm. We went to the one by the con center. Another group
went to the one by the hotel.
By the hotel, and they elected one of their guys to be the Dark Lord of Denny's.
Hey, oh, yes. There was a lot of good gaming, and you do good gaming, you get waffles.
That's right.
I actually know exactly who you're talking about. His name's Ryan. He's a really nice guy.
Yeah, he is. Great guy.
Classic guy.
Yeah.
Hung out with him for a while after Fear the Con during the week of other things that everyone did.
Well, and also, I'm working with Ryan right now on some ways to significantly improve the usefulness of our gamer meetup thread. Mm-hmm. He's got some really neat ideas and some things he's willing to do that I hope to be developing over the next couple of weeks. And I'll be coming back to in future shows to really make that a useful feature, because it did break my heart to talk to a lot of people at Fear the Con or elsewhere where four people would approach me separately and they all live in the same city and are convinced there's no other gamers in their city.
You know,
and I'm like, you realize you're sitting in a freaking convention hall with three other people from your city and none of you know each other.
You know what's sad for me, Dan? Some of them are from St. Louis.
I know.
Send us a PM. We're here.
I know. I know of at least two of them, but that's another story for another time. I'm still developing the details. I will release them as I get them. But so anyways, we have this post-con meetup over at Denny's like we do every year, to talk about what went right, what we want to improve on for next year, some of our observations. And the guys from Kicked in the Dice Bags tagged along with us on that, just because they just happened to be standing there. So we said, hey, you guys want to come with us? And they said, yeah. So as John, not John Grana, but their John, as their John is leaving Denny's to go back to the hotel, he makes a wrong turn. And in true local fashion, a cop decides to pull him over and hassle him about everything under the sun.
Well, he also had a headlight out.
Okay, in fairness to the police, because this is the
he had a headlight out. He missed some turns. He made no less than five violations.
That he was, you know,
he admits, or at least states in his version of the story, that there were four traffic violations he made. So I suppose, in fairness to the cop, he was not just hassling him for no reason. But some of the things he asked him about did seem a little bit like a fishing expedition. But I do not dislike this officer, and you will understand why by the end of the story. In fact,
and that's saying a lot for you.
Oh, it is. In fact, I am calling this officer out in a good way, which you will understand at the end of the story. So he pulls Jonathan over for, like I said, something like four traffic violations, which Wayne listed a couple of them. And at one point, he asks him to step out of the car because John mentioned he had been drinking at one point.
Well, he asked him to step out of the car after he asked him, do you have any weapons on you?
Oh, no. That was after he got out of the car.
I just listened to the story earlier this morning. He asked him about the weapon before he got him out of the car.
Okay, well, he gets him out of the car, point being.
I think I need this whiteboarded out.
Confused.
Can you give me a diagram of how this all played out?
Wayne's my podcasting wife. But anyway, so
I just listened to the story this morning. Far be it for me to bring accuracy into your story.
The point is,
you need to make a cute couple.
He got out of the car at some point, okay? So at some point, he gets out of the car, and the cop asks him whether before or after that point, which is irrelevant to the damn story anyway.
No, it actually is relevant.
No, but it's not.
I just can't get this image of Dan hating Wayne later on.
The whole reason he finds the he's searching him for weapons.
Now I'm going to have to edit that out because you just ruined the punchline. So the cop gets him out of the car and says to him,
don't edit it out. Just beep it out because this is funny.
At some point before or after, are you carrying a weapon? And he says, yes, he was carrying a folding knife, which incidentally in the state of Missouri is not illegal.
Yeah, and the officer told him there's no problem there. That's perfectly legal.
I think as long as it's under, 3.5 inches?
Doesn't matter. If he was
it
in his car.
A freaking bastard sword. And it's
yes,
not
if
illegal
you're in your car, you may conceal any weapon you like. Any weapon you can legally possess, you may have in your car. He was breaking no law. All right, so the cop gets him out of the car.
Except for all the massive heroin he was doing.
As he's searching him, comes across one of those little plastic Chessex boxes of dice. Okay, you guys know what I'm talking about. It's those little transparent, they're not quite cubes, but they're
rectangular,
more rectangular containers that have a bunch of polyhedral dice in them. And the cop pulls this out as he's searching him and says to him, oh, so you were role-playing. And John replies and says, I was up here for a convention. To which the cop replies, oh, yeah, that's right. Fear the Con was this weekend.
So this guy knows what polyhedral dice are, knows what they're used for, which presupposes he or someone he knows is a role player.
Anyone, look, there are four facts this cop had to know. Number one, he had to recognize the box as being dice.
Sure.
All right. Number two, he had to realize that polyhedral dice like this are used for role-playing games because they're not a common sight.
Yes.
Third.
Okay, Poirot, keep going.
He had to know that Fear the Con was an RPG convention.
Mm-hmm.
And fourth, he had to know it was occurring that weekend. Now, any one or two of those facts, you could convince me this guy just picked up at random.
Mm-hmm.
He's a St. Charles cop, at least from where I understand he got pulled over. So he could have stopped by Parks and Rec, looked at their schedule, and saw that Fear the Con was going on this weekend. But to know it was an RPG convention, to know what the dice were.
When we rent the place?
We do not call it an RPG convention.
Because we don't know who we're dealing with. I mean, it's probably cool, but why bother? You know, we just tell them gaming, board gaming.
We tell them it's a board gaming convention. Yeah. We do not tell them it's a role-playing game convention. And so, for the officer to know these four facts, I have to draw one or two conclusions.
The little gray cells.
Yes. Either this guy's a role player, very close to one, or possibly even more so, this guy may be a booter.
Uh-oh.
We need the Law and Order dung-dung at this point.
Dung-dung.
I think it's very likely, too, because as soon as that point, as soon as he says, oh, yeah, Fear the Con's this weekend, basically he's just like, okay, you need to drive better. Now go on,
yeah,
on your way.
He's at the start of this, he had him on four traffic violations and was contemplating a DUI. After he pulls the dice out and says, oh yeah, Fears the Con is this weekend, he gives him the dice back, puts him in the car, and says, have a nice night, and basically walks off. And I'm shortening the story. You can get the full thing from the cells if you want to go listen to their episode. It's number 52 on their show. But the point being, there is no way this cop can have gone through all this and not be a role player, if not a booter. He may be sitting in his patrol car right now listening to this episode. So right now, on this episode, episode 187 of Fear the Boot, officer, whoever you are, I am calling you out. When we do Fear the Con 4, I want you to come to the convention. And if you come bearing your police credentials, I will not only let you in the convention for free, I will personally buy all of your concessions throughout the course of the con and buy you a product of your choice from Casey. So I'm telling you right now, officer
friendly.
I think
Casey has a $100 copy of Rune Wars. You might want to be careful with that product.
I'm telling you right now, officer friendly, you took care of one of my listeners. No, you hassled him. You took care of one of my listeners.
And he probably deserved it.
He did deserve it.
Well, let's face it, it's Jonathan. It's fun to hassle him.
Yeah.
But if you come to Fear the Con 4 with your police credentials to prove who you are.
Yes,
thank you. Thank you very much, sir.
And there's a domestic on Locust Street, so get moving.
Crystal's on Locust Street, by the way. All right, so let's get into role-playing game things and whatever it is we do on this show, which is RPG holidays. So we were having a little conversation about the growing number of role-playing game holidays. And to some extent, I blame Facebook for this, because creating a holiday is as easy as creating a Facebook group and annoying people with, oh, I bet a million people won't join this.
Oh, God, I hate that. Especially, it's like,
are RPG holidays more popular than Nickelback?
The ones I hate are, I support my troops, and if you don't put this in your Facebook status, you're not a real American, and you don't support our troops. And it's like, well, I would like to put in my Facebook status and support our troops and prove that I'm a real American, but the Heart Association wants me to support them, too, and who am I supposed to, and then I'll, Wait, I'm sorry, I hate that.
Oh, I don't see it. What's wrong with trying to extort you with...
Yeah. Guilt.
With pointless platitudes and guilt. Anyways, point being. So, right off the top of my head, I came up with four. And I'm sure there's more than four. But these are just four real quick came to me, which is D&D Day.
Which just happened not too long ago.
Free RPG Day.
I like free stuff.
GM Appreciation Day.
Mm-hmm.
And Read an RPG in Public Day.
I really, really like that one.
All right. I do too.
Now, that one's, in fact, to me, that's the only legitimate one because GMs have no rights.
Here's my question.
You need rights because they have all the power.
you, sir, right there, front row, blue mic, first chair on my right.
Yeah.
You.
So, hit a nerve, did I?
So here's my question to you guys. What do you guys think about this growing number of holidays? Good, bad, useless, irrelevant?
I think it's one of two things. I think that on one hand, they're just cheap corporate shills.
Yep.
I don't have a problem with that. You know what cheap corporate shills are? It's putting coupons for cheap stuff in people's hands.
It's marketing, it's possibly marketing. Effective.
And you know what? If I like a certain product, let's say I'm a huge D&D fan, and D&D is doing some sort of event to push it, I'm all for that. Sure, it's a cheap commercial, but you know what? I get to interact with the product more. I get free stuff, possibly.
D&D got people playing the game out in stores.
Sure.
I mean, but I saw people sitting in stores playing it, and they may be playing it anyway, but...
Yeah, but there's more that show up. I mean, I did our worldwide D&D day here locally, and in that tiny little store that we have locally, we had three full tables, and yeah, they do gaming in there all the time, but there were three full tables, and they were all going, and everyone was having a really good time, and how many were actually new D&D players besides myself? I would say that there was a few who had some limited experience. I don't think that they were regular gamers, but they came out, you know, because it was tied in with the release of, you know, their Player Handbook 3. I didn't realize we needed that many player handbooks, but so it was tied in with the release of a major product for them. And I'll give Wizards credit. They really made it nice. I mean, there was, you know, it was a very glossy adventure, and there's counters, and there's, you know, nice maps and everything.
And my question isn't how many new players were at the table. It's how many people walked into the store, saw these things set up, saw these big DM screens that I saw when I went into stores, and actually asked questions. I think D&D Day is more effective than Free RPG Day.
Well, and I think it's more effective because they have a bit more muscle that they can put behind it. Yeah. And I think that that's where part of some of these things kind of fall short.
I don't think that's why it's more effective. I think it's more effective because it's about people playing the game.
Yeah,
and it's not about giving away free stuff.
I think
that
Free Comic Book Day and Free RPG Day is preaching to the masses. Yeah, and you know what? That's fine because that's internal marketing. Free Comic Book Day gets people into comic books who already read comic books that wouldn't normally read those. Yeah. Well, whatever.
And I mean, when it comes to RPG Day, it is the company's chance to reach their market.
Yeah.
See, with the core audience of a Free Comic Book Day, you're going to get people at least sampling other comic books they may not. So you're still trying to get that core audience to give a little more, which I do think is good.
Here's my take on it. I have no problem per se with the existence of the holidays. I have no problem with the existence of even any individual one of them. In fact, I personally am a big fan of the Read an RPG in Public Day.
I think that is the single best one because all of the others are marketing of some kind. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but what I'm saying is that the marketing is like an internal marketing.
This is outreach.
This is outreach.
Well, I think it's outreach in two ways. One, by reading an RPG in public, not only are you helping to make it a more common sight and thus destigmatize it, but secondly, you're giving people an opportunity to approach you and ask you about the hobby. And third, I think even from an internal standpoint, it's helping to remove some of that gamer shame.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you force yourself to sit in the middle of a park or the middle of a bookstore or wherever you choose to do it and read a source book, you're kind of training yourself a little bit. But here's my basic concern. It's not any one of them. Mm-hmm. It's the number of them.
Yeah.
Now, I agree that every cultural niche needs some kind of a holiday. They need some kind of day to identify with, to celebrate what they do. And I think our culture, just like every other subculture out there, needs something to do that on. But there's something that I call the Hallmark holidays. Mm-hmm. These are holidays that if Hallmark Cards was to go out of business, nobody within 2 years would remember even existed.
Right.
Boss's Day. Forgive Your Parents Day. Crap like that.
Secretary's Day. Oh, wait, Christmas. I'm sorry. Not Secretary's Day. Sorry. Executive
You want
Christmas.
My opinion?
Executive Assistance Day.
You want my opinion? I think Valentine's Day is another one.
Oh, it totally
is. It's a guilt holiday.
Well, yeah, it's a classic holiday. Totally Hallmark made.
What about?
I have never been in a relationship yet with a girl that actually cared about Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day is intricately important to the fabric of our society because it justifies steak and day. Say I'm wrong, sir.
You are not wrong.
Chad, you are correct.
Thank you.
You are correct. But the point being, though, that to me, these holidays start to take on a very Hallmarky feel where they just feel so contrived. It's not something like Christmas, where if tomorrow the A-bombs were to go off, people would keep on celebrating Christmas because it has an intrinsic cultural value.
Mm-hmm.
Valentine's Day does not have that. It's a holiday you celebrate because if you don't, you feel like an ass for not doing it. I said, I've been in relationships with girls where she didn't want to celebrate it. I didn't want to celebrate it. We agreed not to do it. And then we both ended up buying each other gifts anyway because we didn't want to look like heels. And to me, that's what these RPG holidays have become.
I don't think they're that bad yet.
No, I'm not saying they're on that level, but I'm saying to me, that's the feel they have.
Well, that's because they're marketing. Bingo. Except for Read an RPG in Public Day, which is voluntary marketing. But all the others
gamer
are
coming out day.
Yeah, to me, Read an RPG in Public Day is sort of like Gamer Pride Day.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yes, we should have a parade.
With the interesting yes. Gamer Pride.
Gamer Pride.
Gamer
so
Pride Day.
The other three are corporate marketing. Some people are really uncomfortable with that. Some people aren't. I mean, it is what it is. It's just marketing.
I see the D&D Day. That's mostly where I see those games is it's out at tables. Yes, it's a corporate marketing. But if it wasn't a company that was doing it, wouldn't you be saying the same thing about it that you are, you know?
Yeah, but
Read an RPG.
The thing is a lot of those are out in public, but the public is inside of a hobby shop. Yeah. Now, the one we were at,
it's still missing the larger picture, yeah. But it's still out there in public, and that's step one.
But it's in a public where 90% of them, not the one that we went to on that day, because that one's in a mall and people walk through all
the
time.
And the question is, how many other stores are there like that out there?
Not many.
Right. I completely agree with you. If you want to get beyond the marketing level of a holiday like that, like a worldwide D&D day, it needs to be played inside the abandoned storefront, inside the mall, the local mall. And you need to go and take the tables out of the game store, rent that space for a day, play the games in there, and attract that foot traffic audience in that public place. And I think part of the reason why these holidays sometimes they're not being done as effectively as they can, and I'm going to blame my own, you know, real job business for this, is that the media tends to ignore those kinds of things. Free Comic Book Day is kind of cool because you do get a lot of foot traffic in there, especially kids, and there are stacks of comic books which are free, and plus it sounds neat and everybody can identify with comic books. Things like games, not necessarily so much. And I think more attention needs to be made and paid in getting mainstream media involved in trying to raise some awareness of these things so you can get beyond the corporate shill of a lot of these holidays. And I think the whole Read an RPG in Public week or day.
It is a week, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay.
It's actually 4 weeks.
It should be every day.
Stuff like that. I mean, that's fantastic. You'll never gain any actual media traction with something like that. But as a hobby as a whole and as those who participate in that hobby, we can make some of our own personal traction with that.
Well, and the reason why I personally, if I had to pick one holiday to be the flagship holiday of our hobby, I would pick the Read an RPG in Public Day, even though, as I just said, it's actually 4 weeks. It's not one day.
Needs a little bit of focus there.
Well, they decided to put it over the course of a week at four different points during the year. And I understand why they did. It's a long story, but
Keep track of that.
I know. But the point being, the reason I like that one over the other,
I have to set up something in my Outlook calendar.
No, it's so random.
It's because of the fact that
it's quarter four reading week.
Yeah. I think the likelihood of someone
that's a sexy name.
I think the likelihood of someone to approach you to break down barriers and have a conversation is far higher if you're sitting by yourself with a book than if you're sitting with a group of boisterous individuals cloistered around a table. I think the average person is more likely to walk up, ask questions, and engage you if they see you sitting on the subway with a D&D book or a Savage Worlds book or something like that than if you and your friends are already tucked in the back of a gaming store or even at the front of a mall, but cloistered around a table, engaged with each other.
Hey man,
what I wonder is how many people actually realize what those books are, though. If you're flipping through Savage Worlds, someone could think you're just reading a trade paperback.
Well, Savage Worlds may be true. D&D books are freaking big.
Yeah, some of the big hardcover ones.
You can't miss.
They are, but I'm sort of with you on that. Like, how often do you just sort of look around and see people reading a book, and other than just give it a cursory glance, but you actually go up to them and start bugging them about the book?
I don't bug them, but when I see someone reading in public, like if I go to a restaurant, somebody's by themselves reading.
I strain to see what it is.
I'm trying to see what they're reading. It's like, is that any good? But then again,
I'm the same way. I strain to see what it is. If I'm sitting there, whether it's on an airplane or in a restaurant, and I notice the guy next to me is reading a book or the lady next to me is reading a book, I try to see what it is.
I'm not going
to
bother them.
You need to mind your own damn business.
See, I love
reading over my shoulder.
I love the concept of the day. I just wonder how many people realize what it is looking at the cover. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily know if it was a...
Well, I think the idea is that it's just that it's out there.
Yeah.
And that it's acceptable.
I completely support it as the best of the holidays.
I think what we really need to do is it's not that you're just reading it in public. You need to read it aloud in public.
You're rating it? Yeah.
No. Read an RPG aloud in public. That's what's going to get the attention.
I think that's what's going to get you tased.
Hey.
The problem is that gets us the attention we don't want.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
Got to break a few eggs.
Baby steps.
Yeah.
That's right.
When is D&D Day? Is that June 7th?
I think it's past.
I have no idea.
You know what? It varies. I think there's one in the spring and one in the fall. I think it has to do when they have major product releases. God,
yeah. Yeah.
The spring one was Saturday. Do,
yeah. Just go back to the topic.
What?
Nothing.
Okay. Pat said go back to the topic. So let's move on to the other topic for today. Last episode.
Okay.
Is there something you'd like to share with the class, Chris?
No, I guess. All right, I guess we're done. So let's move on.
I think Pat feels very strongly about RPG holidays.
Uh-huh.
Were you abused by RPG holidays as a child?
No, I wasn't. I didn't even know they existed until tonight.
Nice.
I don't think most of these existed when he was a child.
And there's the bigger problem right there.
Well, I don't think any of them existed as of a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So in the last episode, we talked about developing and deepening relationships between player characters, and more specifically between player characters and NPCs. And while we talked about a variety of relationships, we got rather focused on romance. It wasn't in editing the episode, it wasn't the only thing we talked about, but it did kind of keep coming back to romance again and again and again.
And I take the blame for that. It was the topic I wanted to talk about, so I just lassoed you guys into it.
Well, it was actually a topic I wanted to talk about as well, because ever since we talked about it many episodes ago, that was actually our second time talking about it, it's been something some people called us out on. I think they were right. Is why is it that we're so interested in role-playing, yet romance, which is such an integral part of so much of what we do as human beings, is absent from our games. But this episode, that's not what we're talking about. I want to keep talking about relationships between NPCs and the party, and also between NPCs and NPCs, but we are going to forbid the topic of romance this episode because I want to talk about other...
Bromance.
Bromance is fair. Bromance is fair game. But I want to talk about other kinds of relationships. Chad, one of the examples you gave in the last episode...
I don't remember.
I do. Is they walk into the local tavern, the Color Animal Inn, and they walk up to the bartender. And the problem is, in a lot of games, these NPCs, they become go-to resources. They're quest givers, they're quest collectors, they might have a clue, but ultimately they're just a tool for the players to use at some point in accomplishing the overarching plot.
Perhaps they'll even just be used as what I call throwaway role-playing, where they go in there and it's the bartender. It's like, oh, I saunter up to the bar and I'm a dwarf and I like drinking and I've got a Scottish accent and I can't do Scottish accents. And, you know, I role play with the GM and the bartender about how drunk my dwarf is. And, you know, it's fine. It's fun role playing and everybody's having a good time. And then the player turns the character around and the bartender is never mentioned again. And while that happens in real life, do you treat all the NPCs you encounter that are not main characters as throwaway role-playing moments, or just vendors and quest givers?
Right.
Like in an MMO?
And I think certainly you have to accept that there are going to be NPCs within your world who are going to be incidental individuals.
Yeah,
I mean,
they should be.
If you think about it, in the average day,
you shouldn't have War and Peace with your mailman.
Well, and on top of that, if you think about even within real life, in the average day,
the mailmen who are listening to this are, I was like, I'm sad.
One of Carl's cousins is a mailman. He's a very good person, I'll have you know. And he abuses the hell out of his mail truck because whenever he gets this great parking at like very sporting events because the cops will have something blocked off for like the front row parking, and he'll just drive up in a mail truck and they'll just wave him past because they think he's doing something official, and he'll just park and we'll just walk in and
nice.
But
now
anyway,
that's abuse I can get behind.
That's abuse I have benefited from. He's an awesome guy. I actually, if he'd live closer, I'd probably get him as a guest on podcast at some point. But anyway, point being, if you think about it, the majority of people that you interact with on a daily basis are just background to your life. I mean, they're important to somebody, but they may not be important to you. You're going to walk past a lot more people than you're going to stop and talk to, much less return and talk to and develop a relationship with. But I think there is a value in having at least the capacity to develop relationships with the NPCs in a world. And I came up with at least three reasons off the top of my head of why I think this is worth doing. Number one, it creates an emotional investment between the players and the world. Now, the group template and the friendships should create an investment between player and player, or player and GM. But having NPCs that they actually care about or get a kick out of interacting with, they find funny, they find tragic, maybe even they find enraging, the guy they love to hate, It creates an emotional bond between the players and the world. It makes them care about the setting.
What I particularly like are the annoying ones that you come up with sometimes, Dan, where we'll be trying to push the characters off on each other just so we don't have to deal with them.
Like the old lady that kept trying to track you down to make you guys get her mind back. Yeah. The second thing is it adds to a level of realism. We do not live in a world surrounded by only a very small group of people we interact with, and everyone else is simply background. It adds color to the world. Having NPCs that you're developing relationships with, or at least deep enough to develop relationships with, helps add to the realism and believability of the setting. And third, and I think this is something that a GM has to consider, if you have NPCs that are worth worrying about, if you have NPCs that the players get excited about, whether in a positive or negative fashion, in my mind, that means you've already taken the first steps towards building a great setting. And I realize it's kind of similar to point one, but I think it's different enough in nuance that I broke them out into two separate points.
Yeah, I've actually got some thoughts about this because I've definitely encountered numerous NPCs over my lifetime of role-playing that have definitely been valued, say, members of the world. I would almost say I don't even look at them as NPCs. I look at them as they're the people that we interact with.
These are the people in your neighborhood.
Exactly. And it's not, you don't just think, oh, well, that's so-and-so. But I think you sort of hit on an important fact of it is that it's really important for the GM if you've decided, okay, I've got maybe this handful or say, one or two NPCs that are going to be more than just the throwaway guys or whatever, that you have to initiate that development because, I think it falls on you first to sort of start planting that seed or setting that up so the players can react to that so they can see that this is going to be more than just, barkeep that I'm never going to see again. And I think one way that you can do that, one way that I've seen in the past is have them be interactive in the session. Like if you're going to go on a quest for these guys, have them maybe participate in that adventure. They go with you or they show up later on in it where you come to their rescue, whatever, but they're involved. It's not just, oh, yes, please go save my daughter from so-and-so. You go off and do it and you come back and they say, oh, thanks. Mm-hmm. They get involved. Then you develop that relationship and it can become very valuable. So that's the way I've seen it happen before. So,
I think that's one of the reasons why it doesn't happen more often. As I was thinking this through, it's like, why do players tend to not develop relationships with NPCs?
Because they're crappy players. That's why.
That may be a possible reason, but the first heading I came up with is kind of a tautology of the first statement, which is because they don't care. So that's like, well, why don't they care? Chris, do you have like a vibrator?
Yes, he did. I had
my phone up near the microphone and it just happened to go off. Vibrate setting, but
are you paging yourself?
Yes,
no,
he is.
No, my phone is named Pat. And,
I was saying, you're not sexting somebody else, are you, you bastard? Because my phone's put away right now. I was making a point.
But that is one of the first things that I came up with under that heading was the NPCs underdeveloped. And I recognize as a game master, look, you cannot write out every individual in the world.
Right.
But if you have not taken the time to at least make a couple colorful people they're going to run into, that's your own failing. Mm-hmm. And I think the number one reason why player characters do not develop any relationships with non-player characters is the GM didn't bother making them worth knowing.
Yeah. Now, on the flip side of that, too, you can be given a gift from the players because all of a sudden they'll latch onto somebody. You've got just Jim throwaway NPC and all of a sudden the players just are like, this guy's funny or we like this guy and they latch onto him. And then again, as the GM, you pick up on that and you run with it.
That's one of the biggest draws you can drop too, is if the players do latch onto someone and you don't catch that or you don't develop that. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a player, you have no idea if this was a major NPC or just a background character.
Or you have the cool, nifty NPC that you want them to role play with that maybe isn't necessarily 100% part of your story. And you throw them out there and you're like, hey, it's Jimbo. And they're like,
hey. Okay, next. Hey.
You got to be able to perhaps repackage Jimbo or pull Jimbo out and send somebody
bob
else
and
in.
Weave.
Yeah. You got a speed date with your NPC.
That's right.
You want this one? You want this one? You want this one?
So yeah, definitely. It is a two-way street.
No, I haven't.
Uh-oh. I've never speed dated. Yeah. Chris, you've done a lot of things because you're really old.
Well, that's such a new thing, though. That's why I have never speed dated. 2 years, 85 years.
I was just happy to have a date. So,
yeah.
You know what? I related to Pat's point, and Chad, I guess this is kind of more specific for you because going back to the numbered list that Dan had earlier, one of the things that I really try and make an effort to do when I'm designing notes for the evening session or writing out an adventure or whatever is to make sure that I've definitely got names for all the NPCs that they're bound to encounter, whether they're minor or major, and then have at least in my head a backup list of names for people that they may encounter that I'm not prepared for, so that I can come up with that name right away so as to make that person seem real and that, A, I did not just come up with that person on the spot for the very reasons that you had mentioned earlier, Dan. But, Chad, for someone like you who doesn't use notes and you're very off the cuff, do you think that your particular style makes it harder to obtain that emotional investment? Because I'm not saying that they're not going to get it, because if you're a very good GM, you can get past that. But do you think it makes it harder for you to get over that particular situation?
Because I don't assume that the characters are going to latch on to anything I throw at them.
And I always assume that they will. In fact, and I play it like they should.
When they do, that's what I start running with. Of course, I've got an end goal in mind. I generally know what I want to do with the players and what I'd like the players to do. But as far as those moments, you know what I'm talking about, those little moments where they really latch on to an NPC or they really get a kick out of one thing that happens. There are cool things that I would like to happen within a game, but I don't assume that the players are really going to get that. And when they get something, then I take it and I start playing it up more.
The coolest part is when you're running something and you don't expect it at all and the players just latch onto something and they're enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the coolest feelings in the world, is just that interest you see on their face.
Well, I think the struggle that I have as a GM, or at least the fear I have, is that there are two opposite extremes. Opposite extreme number one is you don't bother putting depth or color into anyone or anything in the setting. And if you're good at real quickly coming up with characters and making them come alive just on the spot, maybe that's not an issue. But for someone where that's not their strongest point, you've got to have some preparation in there. You can't just presume that every shopkeeper they talk to without any aforethought on your part is going to be an interesting fellow. And if you create no one interesting, then they're not going to run into anyone interesting. The opposite extreme is you try to give that color to everybody in the setting. You just do this massive shotgun effect where there's 100 different archetypes of people. There's, and I don't mean classes, I mean personality archetypes.
Jungian archetypes.
Yeah. And there's for everybody in the town. And soon you have yourself so buried in notes that you've made an unwieldy game. And so
I think that no matter what style of GMing you subscribe to, you have to be able to do at least a little bit of improv. I mean, that if that's not your thing,
definitely,
you need to develop that to be kind of your thing. I mean, that to me, that's what GM
is. No, I do agree. And what I'm talking about here is not... I would agree, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You cannot throw improv out the window.
Unless you're running a module and it's box text, box text, box text.
Well,
boss
even
fight.
In that case, things are going to surprise you. There's no way the writer of the module thought of everything your players are going to think of. And if he did, I still would run you through it. And there's no way he would come up with what you would have done. There's no way he'd come up with what my wife would have. Some of these off the wall things, you've got to have improv no matter whether you're a module or, you know, running a game you've prepared.
And speaking of modules, this ties into one of the other reasons I came up with on why this oftentimes doesn't happen, which is it's simply not that type of game.
Mm-hmm.
You're just not running the kind of game where they're supposed to care. I mean, it's something straight, whether it's a module or not, this is the type of game where the objective is to rescue the maiden. And the fact is the townspeople along the way are just there to give you bits of information or sell you things. They are not real people, quote unquote. You know, these are not NPCs that matter. The person may not be playing in character. They ought to care about something, but aren't. They're not even bothering to try to care about something. And the third, I think, is something very subconscious that I saw within our own group, though I think we did eventually grow past this, which is the NPC is not a player, and therefore their life is less interesting or valuable than that of a player. So you walk up to somebody, and because they're a non-player character, you don't have to worry about pissing off the player next to you when you ignore them or blow them off. And so you just presume from the outset that they are worth a lot less than the other player characters. They are just the background static behind whatever your group is doing.
I guess related to this, Pat, you know, as a player, and really looking at it from a player's perspective, are you able to sniff those kinds of things out? You know, when it definitely looks like you're encountering an NPC that may not really be central to the plot. I mean, do you find yourself shutting off, or do you try to create some sort of investment? I mean, what, you know, I mean, I kind of know what I do, but I'm very curious, as someone who is, you know, exclusively a player, how you look at that.
Usually what I do is once you start seeing the same NPC multiple times, say more than once, that's really kind of how the sort of the relationship will develop. And I mean, that's kind of obvious. That's just like in real life. Like if you just see this NPC once, you never see him again. Obviously, there's nothing there. But like in your hometown, your home base, whatever, you know, you go back to the same bar and say there's, you know, the bartender that's there, or maybe there's the bouncer that's there, you know, or, you know, looking over the things. And the GM sort of keeps mentioning this guy, or you have some interactions with him every time you go in. Well, right there, you're starting to develop a relationship. And so, and that's the easy thing to key off of. Now, like for me personally, usually when playing, there has to be some kind of trait or characteristic for the NPC that I sort of pick up on or am interested in, or, you know, has something relevant to me. Because, you know, maybe there'll be an NPC that some of the other people in the group really like, but I don't really care for, because it's just, there's no motivation for my character to really care about that person. But that's great, because it's not all about me, and it can be interest for other people. Because it is, it's just like it's a social network. And that's what I was sort of thinking about this whole thing, is that it's really important to do this, because it's not just your player characters that are the world. It's the network that they're able to set up that makes it interesting, because it's good to have these NPCs that you develop a relationship with, because then instead of just going to generic whatever to find out some information about what's going on, you can say, oh, you know what? I'm going to go talk to Gerard that we met back a month ago, and talk to him about, he's got some contacts in the underground.
Well, it makes for some great RP moments.
Exactly.
Well,
it's immersion. It's good for the immersion.
You left off making some snarky comment the last time you left, and now you have to go back to Gerard to get your advice.
Yeah.
Then you can have these great RP moments to pick up from there. Let me ask you guys something before I give a slightly different piece of advice. Just out of curiosity, what are some of the great NPCs you have seen throughout your games that you latched on to pretty quickly, and why?
Oh, I was actually thinking of that when Pat was just kind of relating his point. Two that stand out for me, one was in a Shadowrun campaign, and I give credit for the player for developing this person. Of course, in Shadowrun, you have like generic contacts, you know, that they may fit into a certain field of expertise or whatever. There's one contact worked at the window at a fast food place. And for me, when it started, that was all that this person was. But the player kept going back to this contact over and over and over again, and really developing a relationship with this NPC. And I could see his definite investment to it. And it was strange, because I could see the other players getting invested in what was going on between these two as time went on. And so I latched onto that as well, and eventually built more and more into this character, to the point where...
But how did that happen? What took this guy from being just a contact at a fast food window to being someone they actually cared about?
The player himself was an amazing role player, and really, really got into his character, to the point where it made it fun for me as a GM to see him go and have his character interact with this person. He stayed in character and made it interesting for me, so that I realized I have to go beyond just being this grunt at a window trying to take the cred stick and trying to pass the food. He wants to get more out of this. I need to give him more, because he wants more out of this NPC. And so it just kept going back and forth and back and forth, back and forth, and just kept building over time, to where this person went from being this person behind the window at a fast food counter to actually being a secret agent who was actually monitoring his character and the rest of their shadow running group, and eventually ended up saving them when they ended up fighting the big bad at the end of the campaign. That was one of the factors that contributed to this person being involved, was because the such heavy player investment in this NPC. I guess they really liked the idea of it being a fast food person or something. I don't know. But they really got into it.
You know, Pat, as I'm thinking about this while Chris was talking, because there's nothing else to do.
Pretty much.
I think something you said there bears underlining, which is recurrence of contact. And that was something that Chris just mentioned in his story, mm-hmm. that one of the things that started this relationship was the fact it was somebody they kept going back to.
Yeah.
As I think back over our campaigns, for example, there was the campaign where you guys had a base, and there was a lady next door that had a bakery. Mm-hmm. And every morning she would come over and bring you guys these whatever it was she had extra stock of that day. And she became a part of your consideration of, wow, if we do this, is this going to put her at risk? You guys started investing.
That's a perfect example. I was very endeared to that character. Yeah, I felt a sort of a protective.
But it was because she showed up every morning.
And she was like our it's like a surrogate mother to us as well. She took care of us.
And yeah. If it had just been something where you stopped in one morning to buy dry rations from her and walked off and never talked to her again, that type of relationship would have never developed.
Right.
The NPC was created. The NPC was given an emotive role. In this case, like you said, it was almost like a surrogate mother role. And contact kept recurring as that relationship developed. What about the rest of you guys?
I think you hit on one other thing. Chris hit on one other thing. And that was the guy running in his game, it was role-playing out that character. So the character I mentioned earlier, the one that was driving us crazy, the muffin lady that you were just talking about with Pat, would rescue us from that character. Mm-hmm. Why did that character drive us crazy? Because you did a really good job of role-playing the annoying voice and the annoying mannerisms of the annoying older lady.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to bring up the second one only because I think that you guys are getting just a kick out of it and the story is decent enough. The other NPC that really comes to mind is someone I had in my D&D campaign, and his name was Master Three Balls, and he was...
He was. Please tell me it's a pawn shop broker.
No, he was a businessman, and he was a halfling, and there was a reason, of course, why he was called Master Three Balls. And
I cannot for the life of me picture it. I can't come up with any reason why he would be called.
What kind
that.
Of birth defect would lead to that sort of name?
I hadn't even gone there.
But yes, you have.
The thing is that this character wasn't necessarily he certainly had his quirks, and one of the characters really found out what one of his quirks was later on. But this was an NPC that to me,
Chris, why are you not in prison?
Got a sidekick named Footlong. I mean, you know.
This NPC needed to... To me, he was a critical NPC only in the sense of passing along information and helping get the characters to the next stage of the campaign. And I didn't want them to...
But you called him Master Three Balls.
I know. Well, you see, but I also needed...
You know they're not going to ignore him with a name like that.
No.
I
mean,
he had a definite reason and reputation for it. And it's a longer gaming story, which I won't tell, but it's pretty damn hilarious.
All right, but you know what? Hold on here. I think, though, that Chris did hit on something important, which is the fact that he created something about the character that jumps out.
Yep.
I hope not.
Well, no, it just kind of hung there.
But the point is, it was not.
He was always
just
hanging around.
He could have just as easily created any generic shopkeeper to fill this role, and he didn't. He created something memorable about this character.
No, he created the John Holmes of halflings.
I didn't say that was his sidekick.
Yeah.
He just had three testicles.
He finally had to spell it out there.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not saying
because nobody had inferred that from the very beginning.
Yeah, I'm not saying this is
thank you, Captain Obvious.
I'm not saying this is Shakespeare. I'm just saying that he was on the right track. Let me give an example that goes the other direction. This is a story about real life that I think wonderfully illustrates how to build an NPC that is worth developing a relationship with or is memorable to the players. There is a snow cone stand on the opposite side of town, a place called South County, where I used to live. It's a trailer that sits in the middle of a parking lot of a strip mall.
Like, or shave ice for people in different parts of the country.
That looks just like, I don't know, like a horse carriage left from some kind of gypsy caravan. And the lady that runs it, we call the gypsy lady.
No, we call her Crazy Gypsy Lady.
I don't know what this woman's name is.
Crazy Gypsy Lady.
No, it's just Gypsy Lady. She is crazy, but her name is just Gypsy Lady. I have no idea what her real name is. I think she actually did tell us at one point. I'm 32 years old, going to be 33 later this year, and every time I go, she still asks me how school's going, okay? Just to give you some sense of what this person is like. But we called her Gypsy Lady because the first time we show up, she is just talking about the most random stuff. Here is this random snow cone stand in the middle of nowhere.
Very, very thick Eastern European accent.
Yeah, very thick Eastern European accent. I actually came to find out later that she was orphaned at a young age and actually raised in the Vatican. But I didn't come to find that out until later.
Wow.
But she was wearing all over her body all these medals and pieces of jewelry and whatever. And here's this woman covered in all this silver in this lone wagon, and so we just started calling her the Gypsy Lady. But on top of that, she's out of her mind.
Mm-hmm.
She makes the best...
In an endearing sort of way.
In an endearing sort of way, yeah. She's not, like, annoying or anything. She makes the best snow cones in the world. Her snow cones are absolutely outstanding. If the snow cone stand was open during March, I would absolutely have drugged the people from Fear the Con down there to meet this lady and get her snow cones. They are incredible. But you
They are about 90% syrup. They're awesome.
Yes, it is. By the time you're done, you are drinking it. But this is the makings of a great NPC, because what do you have?
Clearly.
You have somebody who is colorful visibly. You have somebody who is colorful in terms of the interactions they have with you. Oh, they make the best snow cones in town. Right there is a little something that jumps out. This is someone who has...
They have an interesting hidden background.
Yeah, there's an interesting hidden background that I did not find out the first time I met her. But upon returning to her many times over and developing that relationship and giving up, telling her I'm not in high school anymore and finally just accepting it and telling her classes are great, came to find out she was raised in the Vatican as an orphan. This is the makings of a great NPC.
Do you think that that's kind of part of it? That presenting a good NPC to your characters is part of good storytelling, and part of good storytelling is you don't tell 100% of the story in the first 2 minutes of the movie. Yeah.
But you have to give them a reason to come back.
You have to give them a reason to come back, and each time they come back, it's a reward. It's this Pavlovian thing where it's just like each time they come back and they interact with her in a positive way, they get a little bit more of her story, they get a little bit more character.
And
if they're not, it's a market, too. It's this free market idea of if they're not interested and if they don't bite, then they walk away and they don't care and you don't care.
And something else I found is you have to make the person memorable, because you want an idea of what is and isn't memorable. Halfway through a campaign, play a little game. Ask your players to fill in the names of the major NPCs they've encountered.
I can't even do that on the games I run.
my point.
I bet you all my players remembered Master Three Balls.
My point exactly, Chris aside, my point exactly, what you have to do is give them something else to remember. And the easiest way I found to do this is you have to make it so that people jump out as more than their job. He's not just an innkeeper, but instead, this is something that they can file away in an easy and memorable way. In a past campaign, Pat had a grandfather. His character had a grandfather who
touched him inappropriately.
He played the grandfather role, was a little bit of a drinker, claims to have been in the military at some point, and nobody's exactly sure if the story's true or not.
My character was a vehement denier of this.
Nobody was exactly sure if it was true or not, but the guy was always wearing this old beat-up military jacket, telling war stories as if they were real. Look, this is a stereotype, or at nicest, an archetype. Mm-hmm. But this is a simple social cutout. But nonetheless, he was memorable.
Yep.
And when he kept coming around, you know, the first time, okay, he's just grandpa, but then he's coming around telling war stories. And then he's coming over half drunk, claiming that Pat's parents kicked him out of the house because he was drunk. And so he was crashing at your guy's hideout.
Well, I think that
and he kept coming around.
He went from, and it gets back to that, presenting a good NPC is presenting good storytelling, and that you don't reveal everything at one time. He started out as a stereotype. Then as the game went on and we went a couple of sessions and he came back and we interacted with him, he became sort of an archetype. We went away and we came back and a couple of weeks later, and then he kind of went from being an archetype to a character, you know, like a card. He's that guy's a real character. And then again, rinse, wash, repeat. We came back, we interacted with him more because we wanted to find out more about him. Not just, I mean, he did hold some plot information we wanted, but we also wanted to know more about him. And we started role-playing with the character more, and he went from being a card to a full-blown character, mm-hmm. to somebody that we actually considered part of the, quote, team.
I want to end this on a related but slightly different topic, which is deepening the relationships between NPCs. And this is something that I think a lot of game masters don't think about. And I know I did not start thinking about until the first time I did it and noticed the reaction I was getting from my players. It was a pure serendipity sort of thing. But what I'm talking about is creating deep and possibly evolving relationships between the background people of your world. An easy way to launch this one, if you want to gauge how much your characters will care, how much your players will care, a great one to kick this off on is have them go into wherever it is they're going, shop, tavern, doesn't matter, whatever's appropriate to your setting, have it run by a bickering couple. And have some
like, so have them run by you and Wayne.
Yeah, exactly.
There is just something about a bickering couple that gets people's attention, even in my Skies of Glass
game. And it
game,
has to be comedic. Not
oh yeah,
make it comedic.
Absolutely.
Where even in my Skies of Glass
so,
game, if
comedic,
you're the con,
so
I use
her.
That.
Yeah, he'd be like. he comes in with a bottle of tequila and dinner's not right. Yeah, yeah. It's totally appropriate.
Yes,
but
yes.
No, my point being that have a couple that just can't agree on anything. And whenever the wife's up at the counter, she's telling you why the husband's wrong. And as soon as she leaves, the husband comes up and tells you why the wife is wrong. And watch your players latch on to this. And then as time goes on, those relationships, as the world changes, as these people change, as events impact their lives, their relationships may change. When the town comes under siege, suddenly this husband and wife that before were bickering after 30 years of marriage are now all of a sudden realizing the real love they had for each other and cleaving to each other. In a campaign that I ran years ago where I first found this, I had a bickering couple that was running a tavern. The town came under siege. This exact thing happened. They latched onto each other. They ended up dying. And without telling too much of a game story, one of the characters ended up running into the husband in the afterlife in sort of a sorting area. I don't want to quite call it purgatory, but sort of a sorting area. Well, basically
processing station.
Yeah, the processing station.
That waiting room in Beetlejuice.
And all he saw was basically, it was this very empty, nondescript room where the guy did not seem to be aware of anything in his surroundings. And he was sitting there weeping and calling out for his wife. And that created a moment. And it had nothing to do with the players, outside of the fact the players were there to do it. I think a lot of game masters, when they say, wait a minute, a role-playing game is fundamentally a story that is set forth by the game master and forwarded, evolved, and decisions are made by the players, which I think is the correct definition of a role-playing game, at least to me. Why would I bother developing stories that have nothing to do with the player characters? Well, the reason being, because just like the relationship between PCs and NPCs, the relationships between NPCs and NPCs adds depth to the world, adds color to the world, and depending on the nature of a relationship, could possibly even add plot options to the world. In some of our recent campaigns, you guys have had NPCs in the background who weren't the bickering couples. They might have been warring factions. And their relationships evolving as allies come and go and turn into enemies and back into allies. This gives you guys plot options of people you can go to for help, people you can leverage against each other, people you can frame against each other. And if those relationships didn't exist, none of that would happen. And even the plot stuff aside, the great role-playing moments, you have the bickering couple. You walk up and you're trying to buy something. You get the wife to quote you one price. If you don't like it, you get the husband to disagree with her and quote you a different price. And that can make some great role playing.
You know, I do agree just with using that technique. I mean, obviously, make it sparingly, but it is fun because, A, it's a good palate cleanser, so to speak, as opposed to just dealing with one person. I pulled that in my intro event at FearTheCon 3, you know, and it did elicit some smiles. It's just a nice way to kind of either get things moving or just cause a nice little comedic break. I agree with you.
Like I said, I did the same thing in my Skies of Glass game at FearTheCon. I had a couple that was fighting and bickering, and it doesn't even matter what the group is. Everyone pays attention to the fighting couple.
Dan, I totally agree with what you're saying about, you know, adding depth to the world, because for me, and especially in a longer running campaign, which are the ones that I have done a lot and I really enjoy, it's not always about the epic storyline. It's not, you know, it's not just what is your overarching, you know, goal. For me, I like to to be able to take a break from it, you know, sort of a stress relief. And this allows you, like you're saying, it allows you plot points and you can talk to these other people that you've networked with and do just sort of a fluff kind of an adventure for fun. It's not the we've got to save the world. It's, well, it's something small is, and that allows that because all these people that you know.
Even if it is a save the world thing.
Sure.
Have you ever walked away from a movie where at the end of the movie, the main characters have saved the world and what you find yourself thinking as an audience member is you don't care because you never cared about the world they saved?
Yeah, sure.
And adding colorful NPCs that the players care about, that they really understand, that they can relate to, maybe even they love to hate, whatever the case is, that only adds to that emotional investment. And I've seen a lot of movies and a lot of TV shows where by the end of it, I just don't give two craps what happened because I don't give two craps about the people it happened to.
Yeah. That was my problem with Alice, the Tim Burton Alice in Wonderland movie. Great looking movie, and I really like Tim Burton's stuff, but the characters were never developed. And not in a way that presupposes you read the book. I mean, they just didn't have any dialogue. They were too busy doing the different special effects or doing the scenes, they didn't talk amongst each other. I liked Alice because she had 90% lines, and so I kind of started caring about her character. But all the other characters in the movie that I was supposed to care about, I didn't, because they didn't have any dialogue. They weren't role-playing, they weren't acting, they weren't on screen, they didn't get the spotlight. Whatever you want to call it, same thing applies to a game. You could have the most colorful characters in the world, all the special effects, all the development, all the background story, but if the audience or your players don't bite, or you're not presenting them, it's just not going to go anywhere, and people just aren't going to care. And I don't hear birds in the background, Chris. I hear a dog in the background.
There
this
is,
time.
I think, a random dog back there somewhere.
It's Iowa. Get your rifle out and fix it.
That's true.
Fix it. I lie.
All right. Well, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap this one up here. Quick reminder, don't forget to check the show notes for Reina's Wings, which is now turned from just being a charity to also being a charity and an industry-backed contest. We look forward to seeing what we can do there. Kmart was the only company at the corporate level to beat Fear the Boot Stonations last year. This year, we're going to kick their ass. I'm just telling you straight up. And secondly, also don't forget to check out the Blood Bowl League if you're interested in getting in on some group play on Blood Bowl online. And thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
Literally.
Bye. This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in a non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.